Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We are looking at a stack of sources today that all seem to collide on a single date on the calendar. Monday, February 16th, 2026.
Which, depending on how you look at it, is either just a, you know, a really busy Monday in the tech world.
Or it's the start of a completely new era.
Exactly.
We're calling it Tech and Night. And if you just scan the headlines, it looks like, well, noise. You've got a server startup in California raising money. A diplomatic summit in India.
Some new satellite internet licenses in Vietnam. A bunch of video game remakes.
On the surface, it's a salad. Totally mixed.
Yeah, there's no obvious connection there.
But when you actually read the analysis, a very, very clear picture starts to form.
Yeah.
For the last, what, 10 years, the tech industry has been obsessed with more.
Oh, absolutely. More chips, bigger data centers, more parameters in the language models. It was the era of brute force.
Right. Quantity was the primary metric. If you had the biggest server farm, you won. Simple as that.
But the thesis we're exploring today is that on this specific Monday, the pendulum, it really swung back. Mm. We are moving from a world of quantity to a world of quality.
And maybe more importantly, a world of local control.
That's the through line. Every single story we're covering today, from, you know, the basement server room all the way to the streets of New Delhi, it's about efficiency, autonomy, and moving power back to the edge of the network.
So to map this out for you, we're going to build a stack. We'll start at the bottom with the physical infrastructure, move up to governance, then hardware, network, software, and finally, we'll hit the cultural layer.
I like that structure. It really shows how the pattern repeats itself at every single level.
Okay, let's start at the foundation, infrastructure. The big story here involves a company called Oxide Computer. They just announced a massive $200 million Series C funding round.
Which is an enormous amount of money for a hardware startup.
Yeah.
I mean, VCs usually hate hardware. It's so capital intensive.
Software scales infinitely, right? Metal does not. So why are investors throwing this kind of cash at Oxide? To understand that, we have to look at what's being called the public cloud trap.
This is a pain point we've seen building for 5 or 6 years now. The narrative used to be so simple. Don't build your own servers. It's too hard. Just rent space from Amazon, AWS, or Microsoft Azure.
And for a startup, that makes perfect sense. But the sources are pointing out that for large enterprises, we're talking banks, defense contractors, healthcare networks, that rental model has become a complete nightmare.
For two big reasons. First, the bill. You look at your monthly AWS statement and you realize you're paying enough to build a new headquarters every single year.
It's the difference between renting an apartment and buying a house. At some point, you want to own the equity.
And second, privacy. I mean, if you are handling classified government data or sensitive patient records, you might have legal requirements that say that data physically cannot leave your building.
So you can't put it on a server somewhere in Virginia.
You can't. But here's the catch, and this is where Oxide comes in. These CIOs, they want to leave the public cloud, but they don't want to go back to the dark ages of managing these messy, mismatched servers.
They love the experience of the cloud.
They love clicking a button and spinning up a database. They don't want to give that up.
So Oxide's pitch, and this is led by Brian Cantrell and Jess Rizal.
Who are, I mean, absolute legends in systems engineering, just giants in the field.
Exactly. Their pitch is basically, we will sell you the cloud, but it fits in a rack in your basement.
It's the cloud on-prem model.
Hmm.
But the innovation here isn't just selling a metal box. Dell can sell you a box. HP can sell you a box.
Right.
Oxide is selling a tightly integrated stack. They design the hardware and the software to work together perfectly.
And the sources mentioned they're using the REST programming language for safety and a specialized hypervisor architecture.
Right. The hypervisor is just the traffic cop that manages the virtual machines. By building their own and using Rust, they eliminate a lot of the bloat and the security holes that you see in legacy servers.
So the user experience is basically, I have the ease of AWS, but I own the machine, and the data never leaves my four walls.
It's a complete return to local control. And frankly, it's a direct shot across the bow at Amazon and Microsoft. The prediction here is that the giants will have to respond.
They'll have to create better outposts or dedicated regions to compete.
They have to. Because if their biggest customers, the ones with the deepest pockets and the most sensitive data, decide to take their ball and go home,
then the public cloud business model takes a massive, massive hit. And Oxide is giving them the tools to leave.
That's the first layer.
So that's the physical layer. We are moving servers back to the local edge. Now let's move up the stack to the governance layer. And for that, we're leaving California and heading to New Delhi.
To the India AI Impact Summit.
Now, usually when we talk about tech regulation, we're looking at Brussels or Washington, D.C. But the guest list for the summit in New Delhi is, well, it's staggering. You have Sundar Pichai from Google, Sam Altman from OpenAI, Jensen Huang from NVIDIA.
Plus diplomats from the U.S., China, Israel, Europe. I mean, everyone is there.
So this is not a trade show.
No. No, this is what analysts are calling layer three of the stack, technology diplomacy.
Why India? Why is New Delhi suddenly the center of the universe for AI rules?
It comes down to leverage, pure and simple. India has positioned itself as the swing state in the global tech war. You have two superpowers, the U.S. and China, vying for dominance. And then you have India.
With 1.4 billion people.
That is the leverage. That is 20% of the world's population. If you are Google or OpenAI, you simply cannot afford to be locked out of the Indian market. It's the biggest growth engine on the planet.
But it's not just consumers, right? The sources also mention the supply side.
Correct. India produces a massive percentage of the world's engineering talent. So New Delhi has this incredible dual leverage. We have the users you need, and we have the talent you need to build the products.
And now they're using that leverage to set the rules.
Yes. Very aggressively. On things like data localization, which is similar to what we just discussed with Oxide, India is saying, if you want to operate here, the data stays here. And the AI models you use here, they must be audited by our standards.
And here's the fascinating ripple effect. If India sets a really strict standard for, say, how an AI algorithm is audited for bias or for safety,
Google isn't going to build a separate, worse version of its product for the rest of the world. It's just too expensive to maintain two different code bases.
So the regulations agreed upon in New Delhi on this Monday, they effectively become the global standard.
The Brussels effect is becoming the New Delhi effect.
So you have this interesting parallel. Oxide is bringing the hardware back to the local company. India is bringing the governance back to the local jurisdiction.
It's all about asserting sovereignty. It's a statement. We aren't just going to take what Silicon Valley gives us. We're going to decide how it works in our country.
Okay, let's zoom in. Weigh in. From geopolitics to the microscopic level. Story number three is about the hardware itself. We're talking about neuromorphic chips and a big breakthrough in robotic vision.
This is one of those technologies that sounds like science fiction until you realize it's actually just biology.
The sources describe it as event-based vision. For anyone listening who isn't a chip engineer, the best way to think about this is to compare a standard camera to your own eyeball.
That's the perfect analogy. So think about a standard video camera. It records frames, usually 30 or 60 frames per second. It takes a full picture, saves it, takes another, saves it.
Even if nothing in the scene is changing.
Right. If you point a camera at a blank white wall, it is furiously processing massive amounts of data about that blank wall.
Which is just wildly inefficient. It's processing sameness.
Total waste of energy and bandwidth. Now think about your eye. If you stare at that same white wall, your brain basically idles. You aren't processing the wall. But if a fly lands on it,
your neurons fire.
You only process the change.
Okay.
That is what this new neuromorphic chip does. It doesn't record frames. Its pixels only activate when they detect a change in light or motion.
So if 90% of the scene is static, the chip is doing 90% less work.
Which leads to a massive drop in energy consumption, about 10 times less power. But the real game changer is latency.
The reaction time.
Exactly. Because the chip isn't bogged down processing useless background data, it can react to the event, the fly, or the pedestrian stepping into the street almost instantly, near zero latency.
So for a self-driving car or an industrial robo-arm, that split-second difference is everything.
It's the difference between hitting the brakes in time and not. This is hardware-level AI. We aren't relying on software to filter out the noise anymore. The chip itself is smart enough to ignore the noise from the very beginning.
Again, quality over quantity. Don't give me more pixels. Just give me the relevant pixels.
And do it at the edge, right there in the robot, without needing to send data to the cloud. It fits perfectly into our theme.
Now, even if these robots are processing data locally, they still need to talk to each other. They need a network. Which brings us to story number four, SpaceX and Starlink.
Specifically, Starlink entering the Vietnamese market.
On the surface, this looks like a standard business deal. Starlink gets a license. But the context here is just so crucial. Vietnam isn't just a random market.
No, not at all. Vietnam has become a critical manufacturing hub for the global economy. A lot of electronics manufacturing has moved there from China. It's this dynamic 98 million person economy.
But like a lot of fast-growing economies, the infrastructure on the ground, the fiber optic cables and the cell towers, is really struggling to keep up.
It's the classic last mile problem. It costs billions of dollars and takes years to dig trenches and lay fiber to every factory and every village.
And Starlink just skips the trench digging.
They bypass the geography entirely. And by getting licensed in Vietnam, SpaceX has effectively completed a satellite canopy over all of Southeast Asia. They're already in the Philippines, Indonesia, now they have Vietnam.
This has to be terrifying for the local telecom companies. I mean, imagine being a local ISP in Hanoi, trying to justify the cost of upgrading your network, when Elon Musk just flips a switch and offers high-speed internet from the sky.
It's an existential threat to the legacy providers. Starlink is basically saying, we don't need your ground infrastructure at all.
But hold on, there is a tension here, right? We've been talking about local control with Oxide and India. With Starlink, it feels like the opposite. You are connecting Vietnam, sure, but the pipe is owned by an American company.
That is the trade-off. It's a really interesting one. It empowers the local user, the factory owner in rural Vietnam, gets world-class connectivity instantly. That's local empowerment. But the infrastructure is centralized in the hands of SpaceX.
It's efficiency at the cost of digital sovereignty.
That's a great way to put it. And Musk's strategy seems to be creating these pockets of digital economy. You don't need the whole country to have good roads if the key factories have incredible internet.
You create islands of high-speed connectivity.
Exactly. And those islands can participate in the global market, regardless of what the local grid looks like.
Okay, so we've built the server, we've set the rules, we've built the eye, and we've connected the network. Now, we need someone or something to do the work. Story number 5, OpenClaw.
And this is probably the story that will have the biggest impact on our daily lives. This is the real rise of agentic AI.
We need to make a really clear distinction here. Most people know generative AI, that's ChatGPT. You ask it a question, it writes you a poem or summarizes an email, it produces text.
Right, it's a talker. Agentic AI, like OpenClaw, is a doer. It doesn't just chat, it acts.
So, practically speaking, what does that actually look like?
Well, instead of asking the AI, how do I file my taxes? You give the agent your login credentials and you say, file my taxes. And the agent goes to the IRS website and navigates the menus, clicks the buttons, uploads the PDF, and it hits submit.
It actually controls the interface.
Wow. It creates a layer of automation on top of the existing web. OpenClaw is significant because it's specifically designed to handle messy tasks, you know, websites that are poorly designed or workflows that require some judgment.
This connects back to that economic layer 2 analysis. If you have software that can do the clicking and typing of a human worker,
then the whole equation for labor changes. We're looking at less quantity of labor yielding higher quality output. If one human can supervise 10 of these agents, that human becomes 10 times more productive overnight.
But we have to talk about the risk. I mean, if I give an agent my bank login.
Yeah. That's the scary part. That's the double-edged sword. If ChatGPT makes a mistake, you get a hallucinated fact. If an agent makes a mistake or it gets hacked, it could transfer your entire life savings to the wrong account. It could delete all your work files.
The sources mention that secure variants are already popping up. Things like PopeBot and PicoClaw.
Of course. The market is rushing to build guardrails. But the shift has happened. We're entering an era where software has hands. It can touch the digital world and actually change it.
It's incredible efficiency, but it requires a massive, massive amount of trust.
And it demands a whole new kind of auditing. You aren't just auditing code anymore. You're auditing actions.
Let's take a breath and move to the final layer of our stack, the cultural layer, which seems a little strange, but we're talking about video games.
Which might seem trivial after we just discussed AI controlling our bank accounts, but, you know, gaming is often a leading indicator for consumer psychology.
The big news this week is a flood of releases. Mario Tennis Fever, Ride 6, and remakes of Yakuza and YSX. The key word here is remakes.
Or sequels. It's all familiar territory.
A cynic would say Hollywood has run out of ideas and now the gaming industry has too. But there's a business logic here that fits our theme perfectly.
It's not about running out of ideas. It's about quality assurance. The cost of making a AAA video game today is astronomical. We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars.
So if you launch a brand new IP and it flops,
the studio goes bankrupt. It's just too risky. So the strategy shifts. Instead of flooding the market with 50 mediocre new games, that's quantity, You focus all your resources on polishing a single, high-quality experience that you know has a built-in audience.
You know people love Mario. You know people love Yakuza.
It's a flight to quality. And it connects directly to the hardware sales. We have the PS5 Pro and the Switch 2 entering the market. And to sell a new console, you need software that looks and feels incredible.
And the safest way to guarantee that incredible feeling is to give the player the best possible version of something they already love.
Exactly. You leverage the nostalgia, but you deliver it with the highest possible fidelity. It's the same pattern we saw with the servers and the chips. We are done with more stuff. We want better versions of the stuff that actually matters.
So let's zoom out and look at the whole board. We have servers moving back into the basement. We have India demanding local governance. We have chips that process data at the source, Starlink bypassing the middleman, agents doing the work, and culture focusing on high-fidelity known experiences.
If you look at these six stories as a single narrative, it's a story about the war for infrastructure and data control.
It really feels like a cohesive ecosystem when you put it that way.
It is. Oxide brings the data home to the enterprise. India sets the rules for how that data is governed. The neuromorphic chip processes the visual data locally on the device. Starlink connects it to the world, and OpenClaw takes action on it.
So if we take the 100-year view, if we look back at February 16th, 2026, from the year 2126, what do we see?
I think we will see this as the moment the internet stops being a library. For the first 30 years or so, the internet was a place you visited to get information.
And now?
Now it's the engine that runs the physical world. It's the day we decided to make the cloud local, to make the hardware intelligent, and to give the software the power to act.
That is a massive shift.
Right.
And there is a real warning here for the current giants, isn't there?
Absolutely. Whether you are Amazon or a local telecom monopoly or a government regulator, the board has changed. If you keep trying to sell volume and centralization in a world that has clearly pivoted to precision and local control, you are going to be left behind.
You can't just sell more anymore.
You have to sell smart. That's the lesson of Tikken Knight.
Before we wrap up, though, I want to leave you with one thought, and it circles back to OpenClaw.
I have a feeling I know where you're going with this.
We talked about efficiency. We talked about agents doing our taxes and managing our lives. But if we are entering a world where AI agents have the power to decide and act on our behalf...
Who is watching them?
Exactly. If the agent audits my finances... Who audits the agent?
And who audits the agent that audits the agent? It's the recursive problem of autonomy. If we prioritize efficiency above all else, at some point, we hand over the keys.
And we might just wake up one day and realize we've automated the very thing that makes us human choice.
That is a heavy thought for a Monday.
That's why we do the deep dive. We'll be tracking how these six stories evolve over the next few months.
It's going to be a fascinating year.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Stay curious.